Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness? What should we do with 1 Timothy 2? My name is Matthew Lee Anderson, and you are listening to another episode of Mere Fidelity, the podcast where we think together about the Word of God and the world we live in. This episode is brought to you by our friends at Lexempress. You can get all the Lexempress Mere Fidelity books of the month at lexempress.com/merefidelity, including the April book of the month, Zwingli the Pastor, A Life in Conflict by Stephen Ecker. This is for the history and theology buffs. You are going to theology level 202, not 101, if you're reading and thinking about Zwingli in the context of the Reformation, which I think we should do. I think he's underrated. We should definitely spend time on him, given that several, at least one member of this podcast, probably two, are descendants of Zwingli in terms of his view of baptism. And given that Karl Barth updates Zwingli's account of baptism in the 20th century, I think he's worth wrestling with. So Zwingli the Pastor, you can get 40% off on that at lexempress.com/merefidelity. Shout out as well to the merry band of patron supporters. If you want to join the crew there, you can do so at merefidelity.com. All right, so you can hear Andrew laughing at me already. He's with us back, and Alistair is here as well. This podcast is a response to a listener inquiry, which we like to do every now and then. Someone emailed us, asked us what we make of 1 Timothy 2, effectively, and this passage on letting a woman be quiet and all submissiveness. And it's actually a twofer, because just a couple verses later, Paul writes that she will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith and love and holiness with self-control. Also a very perplexing verse. There's all sorts of energy happening on... There's been lots of discussion about this for 2,000 years, so this is not a new amount of energy. But it feels like evangelicals are investing a lot right now on this passage, on Ephesus and what's happening in Ephesus. There's a new book out on Artemis of the Ephesians from an evangelical publisher, and how understanding Artemis is going to be the key to understanding 1 Timothy 2. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. But this is just a perennial question, I think, for the church, but it's certainly within evangelical context is particularly a fraught one. I'm curious, Andrew, you have thought about this passage a lot, and this verse particularly. I'm interested to hear what you make of it, but I kind of want to start with like one weird question, which is that all this starts like in verse 8, if you take that as the beginning of Paul's sort of new body of thought, with desiring that in every place men should pray, lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. Likewise, then he starts talking about women. I'm just curious, the men praying in public places, does that bear on how we should interpret the scope of 1 Timothy 2:11 when Paul starts talking about women and submissiveness and all of that?
Okay, well, hello, and good to be with you, and it's good to be back, I should say. I think in most interpretations it does. I think most people. So this was actually a question from a friend of mine, Becky, who got in touch and said, and I just think this the whole thing is a fascinating issue, really important passage, and I like gravitating towards the most difficult passages because I think they often reveal more about us, and they expose things that we think or assume that the Bible doesn't, and vice versa. But I think it does. I think it's quite hard to read I think often in a lot of interpretations, if people see the men as referring to praying in public worship, they're more likely to see the focus of 2:11 to 15 about women as relating to public worship. And if they don't want to see the women bit as relating to public ministry and instead say, no, this is just more about home environments or anywhere in life, then they're more likely to want to restrict the in every place in verse 8 and say, that's not really talking about public worship. That's saying wherever you are, wherever men are, they should raise their hands in prayer And so for me, the constraint, actually, I think because at the start of chapter two, Paul says, you know, first of all, I want prayers to be offered. And he then gives a thing about how he wants people to pray. The transition into men is very kind of straightforward from there. And then at the end of chapter three, Paul uses the image of this is, I'm writing these things to you so that you may know how to conduct yourself in the church, which is the household, the pillar, the buttress, and so on. And so I tend to read chapters two and three as relating to that sort of corporate context. And I feel like that works for all of the different subsections. You have a bit on men, a bit on women, a bit on prayer, a bit on men, a bit on women, a bit on elders, a bit on deacons, a bit on women. That to me holds together well. But I think that for people who say, no, the chapter 11 to 15 is about something else, they would generally also then say, and maybe the men also is not about a public ministry context, it's something else. So I think you've got to be relatively consistent. Otherwise, it does look a little bit selective on the context, I think.
I was gonna quip, make a joke about whether as a charismatic you're obligated to think that in every place means
hands
that
straight up
men
I know, like I have joked. There was a friend of mine who used to say that there would be moments in the church service where it looked like somebody at the back of the room had a huge bell rope that was attached to the arms of everyone in the room, and as soon as they pulled it at this point of the worship, all the hands would go shooting up, and it is a little like that. So yes, that's how charismatics pray all the time.
Can I just ask one other question about the context of this passage, resharing a little bit farther back to the beginning of chapter two? You say that chapters two and three hold together. One of the things that I find very interesting about the beginning of chapter two is the stress on that these prayers are to be made for all people, for kings and those who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way, which is good and pleasing in the sight of God as Savior, who desires all people to be saved. There's some sort of, like, this is, I think, a very important verse for political theology, that there's a really strong sense in which what Paul is admonishing the church to do in terms of its conduct has reference to the broader world, that there's some sort of missional stake here, that in one way, the church's reputation is on the line, and Paul is attentive to that, even as he then goes into talking about the internal ordering of the church's worship. How much does that sort of missional context or framing matter for understanding what's happening later on? Right? Because I read some of these verses and I think, like, some of this, that makes me think that maybe some of this is contextual, right? If it is particularly scandalous that women would act in a particular way relative to the broader society, then that might put emphases in different places. Now, Paul's going to appeal to creation, so we can talk about that. But in terms of the emphases or the accents, what Paul is thinking about, it is embedded in this broader cultural context, and he does seem to be sensitive to what happens internally in the church affecting kings, rulers, those in authority, the public reputation of the church. Do you think that weighs at all in terms of how we should read this?
Yeah, I do, but I think that's true of every passage in the New Testament. I don't think there's any bit of the New Testament that isn't contextual. I think of course the accents are being drawn out for particular issues, some of which we can immediately identify. We can see there are issues with, you know, certain false teachers in the church. There's issues with widows in the church. There's issues with rich and poor in the church. There's issues with false doctrine of various kinds, some asceticism floating around. There's issues with approaches to government. Just like you would with any letter, I think you can see, you know, you do the same in Corinth or in Rome or Galatia or whatever. And in some of those letters, the background is more explicit. It's pretty obvious when you read Galatians what's been going on. Whereas when you read Colossians, there's probably more room to debate exactly what the heresy was. And I think this one is probably in between, which leaves lots of room for people filling in the blanks. I don't know what the Artemis book you're referring to is, but I've seen a counter book in many ways in the last year as well, of Artemis is really not the solution to all of this stuff, because Artemis has been completely misunderstood and over-applied and over-interpreted by, I think, Sandra Glahn, maybe. So I find it very, I do think it's contextual, and I think we've got to read it within that sort of wider, but I don't think that's unique to this book. I think the reputation of the gospel is always pressing to Paul. And to me, the contextual factor that I think is probably distinctive in these chapters that I do think can really help us is the fact that is the metaphor Paul uses for the church, where I think in you have in a book like Romans, where Paul will use, obviously appeals to various metaphors, but we'll talk quite a lot about the church as an olive tree, particularly in chapter 11, and is talking about union of Jews and Gentiles. Or he talks in 1 Corinthians a lot about the church as body. And in 1 Timothy, he talks about the church as household. And I think that even the difference between the way he talks about men and women and leadership and public ministry in the church is somewhat accented by the fact that in 1 Corinthians, he's talking about a body, so he emphasizes interdependence. And in a household, he's emphasizing order, and that partly because of the way the metaphor works. And the church, of course, is both household and body. And I think in some ways that contextual feature I find more illuminating for why this letter seems to be quite distinctive in what it says about some of these issues relative to some of the other Pauline letters. Which obviously some interpreters go, well, that's because Paul didn't write it, but I'm not there at all. And I think in some ways his metaphorical world for thinking, more than his particular standing of the church vis-a-vis secular powers or whatever, is primarily the issue that's driving why it sounds distinctive in places, I think.
I think one key factor here that is contextual that's not commented upon enough is that this is a stage of evolution in the church's ecclesiastical order. If you think about the earliest church, you'd have a number of household congregations that would be ordered very much in an existing household. And so we have some window into this in places like Romans 16, where there are churches meeting in a particular person's household. And within that household, many of the things that you'd expect within a more domestic order are shaping the way that the congregation operates. And so the person who's presiding would naturally be the person who was the head of that particular household. And if there was someone who was the sponsor or the host, there would also be a particular role that they would have within that community. And that context is one within which the roles of men and women would be rather different from one in which the church order was more external to the household and was more formalized. And what we see, I think, in places like 1 Timothy is the move as those household churches increasingly become part of wider city churches. And those city churches would replace the initial less formal office of the elders, the presiding person within that particular household, with a more formal recognized office and a gathering of people who are elders over these various congregations within the city, representing the church externally and also maintaining its internal order. And that shift also accounts for some of the shift that we see in the place of men and women, where in the earlier church, there would be a lot more, because it was in a domestic context, there would be a lot more latitude for women's roles within the church, outside of being the overseer, but women would be the ones who were hosting the church, or women would be the chief sponsor of a church, or there would be maybe a group that were gathered primarily as a women's Bible study that grew into a larger congregation. Maybe there were a number of younger Christians who were of a different social class, number of slaves from a woman's household, for instance. And in that situation, it would be very natural that the woman within that situation would be more dominant. A person who was the head of the household, like Lydia, and an extensive household with servants and others, and a larger women's Bible study that had become part of that group. When that became incorporated into a larger citywide congregation, those roles would start to fall away. And that's something that we observe and has been written about by people like R. Alistair Campbell and Alistair Stewart in their works on early church office. And this is also something that brings together a number of elements that surround 1 Timothy chapter 2. So in chapter 1, Paul is writing to Timothy in how to order the church of God. He's teaching him to uphold certain doctrine, to establish certain people as well. And then in chapter 3, it's about establishing elders and overseers. And so we have this broader context, I think, that makes a lot of sense of why those things would be problems that Paul's addressing, why there is a need for an establishment of some sort of order in this context. And then also understanding the sort of shift that's taking place. And that, I think, gives us more to work with in terms of context than anything to do with Artemis and others, which are a bit more speculative. This, I think, is something that very clearly leaves skid marks on the biblical record.
Did you just say skid marks?
Yes, if you want to understand why something has changed direction, and if you're claiming that
word clearly means something very different in Eastbourne than it does in Durham or Stoke or wherever you are at the moment. That
New York, eating bagels.
I'm not going to ask.
Don't pry. Let's just, any English listeners in the South will know what I mean. Good grief.
I was, so.
Thanks for raising the tone, Andrew.
That's why I'm here.
To be clear, I think I introduced some jokes earlier, so you know he's just in keeping with the atmosphere. So I'm just curious, the growth, the incipient organization, the growth of the church's order as a result of its own growth numerically, its urbanization, those sorts of phenomena, all these different ways of contextualizing this passage. Paul appeals to Genesis in verse 13. So Andrew, I'm just curious, now that we've said a lot about the context, how do you read verses 11 through 15? Like, what is the context, or like what are the limits that Paul is putting down? Where do they apply, and like, how should we understand it today?
So that's like obviously the whole of the rest of the conversation, I think. So I'm not going to give a definitive answer now. I think what typically happens is the complementarian interpretation generally is this is a restriction on either all public teaching or whatever people mean by authoritative public teaching and preaching in the gathered church, but to men, and usually people would say qualified men, maybe elders as well, along the lines of chapter 3. And this is a restriction, and it's a restriction because there is something creational at stake here, not just because there is something contextual at stake here, as per verses 13 and 14. And complementarians generally read it that way, and they would say this is a restriction on public teaching in the gathered assembly, which in many churches, not mine, but in many churches would mean that only men preach sermons or teach whatever it is. The egalitarian interpretations, there are lots of different ways of doing it, but obviously people don't generally, they don't do it like that. And so what they'll have lots of ways of saying that's not what's going on. Either they'll limit the scope of the text by contextual factors that some of which we touched on earlier. Maybe this is unique to Ephesus, is unique to this particular problem of false teaching. It's unique to whatever it might be. Maybe people will say, oh, well, this is addressing the women because the men have been called out already in chapter 1. They might say authenteo is a word that does not mean have authority. It means overpower or master, domineer maybe, or, you know, even murder is sometimes thrown in as, you know, based on some of the parallels in the noun in ancient literature. And so this is basically limiting, in some case, you know, Tom Wright or someone like that is quite, he translates it, I think, I'm not saying that women should dictate to men or try and take over. Rather, they should be able to learn undisturbed. In other words, really softening the force of verse 12 to the point that it sounds completely different from what you would see in most translations. And then there would be various other explanations as well of what that phrase means. It's a negative word. And so he's basically saying women shouldn't try and take over the church. And in that sense, you can apply it like that today. So those are the two kind of major schools, and obviously lots and lots of ways, lots of sub-variants of both of those. I wrote an article 10 years ago on 12 different ways of reading this text, and there have only been more since then that I've become aware of. And what I do, which is obviously I'm more complementarian in my convictions, but in a strange way, I think I am also trying to... The challenge for me is actually not the restriction, and it's not the word authenteo, which I basically believe, having looked at lots of these sources and so on. I think the attempts to say this is exclusively negative word are not convincing, that it can be and sometimes is a much more neutral term, and that in one of the key ancient parallels, it's a word that someone uses of themselves to say, this is what I did, and they're saying they're looking for praise for having done it, which I don't think you'd do if it was murderer or equivalent like that. But I think for me, the challenge is somewhat different. It's that Paul is restricting teaching here, and he is open, teaching is used in a way that's much more broad and general and open to nearly anybody, it seems anybody in the church, in Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 14, Colossians 3. And so for me, the challenge is, why and what do we do about the fact that Paul restricts teaching, not just here, but in several cases in the pastorals, and makes it sound like it's not only the preserve of elders, but the preserve of some elders. You know, the elders are worthy of double honor, especially the ones who labor in preaching and teaching, that sort of thing. Elders must be able to teach. Why does he use the word in this quite sort of formal, restrictive sense in the pastorals, and a much looser, willy-nilly, and everyone's using their spiritual gift, and if it's teaching, you go for it, guys, in the general letters, which is related to Alistair's point just now. And so for me, that's where I've often tried to focus my work, is in navigating the distinction, the different ways in which Paul seems to use this word in the pastorals versus the general letters. But that isn't really what most complementarians do, and it's not really what most egalitarians do either. So I'm plowing a slightly quirky furrow there, I think. And it may not have convinced either of you. I think we talked about that years ago on when it came to preaching in church. So that's what I tend to do with it. And then we can get to 15, verse 15 later. But I don't find the attempts to make authenteo an exclusively negative word convincing. I think that there is a very compelling argument, that Andreas Kirstenberger's argument, that when you say, I do not promote something and not something else, that they're either both positive or both negative, but it's, you never see one being positive and one being negative. So if teaching is a good thing, then authenteo would be. And I find that very convincing. I don't think there's anybody has overturned that conclusion since he's written that article. So I'm inclined to think he is limiting teaching and authenting whatever we say. But mastery, not a bad word, you know, bad modern translation, because it has the sense of the authentic master copy, which obviously is where we get our word authentic from, as well as authority. And I'm pretty convinced that is what he's basically limiting what it looks like he's limiting in most of our English translations. But why that is different from what happens in some of the other letters to some degree, I think, is something worth more reflection.
Yeah. And Alistair's explanation goes a long ways to that. Alistair, Andrew mentioned that he's not sure whether he's persuaded both of us. I'm curious, has he persuaded you on this point?
I think when I'm approaching a text like this, part of what I'm trying to do is to redistribute the weight so that we're not resting too much upon the debatable points. And we recognize there are things like the meaning of that term that we don't want to put too much load-bearing capacity upon a detail like that. And so I'm thinking about what other parts
Come on, Alistair. Oh, I'm going to call you out just for one second.
Because I will get to your point, but
I believe in our last conversation, you spent a long time talking about 531 fish and why it was
153, Matt.
Sorry, 153. Look, that's how much I paid attention.
Part of the point with that is it's not treated as load-bearing. I'm not saying you have to accept that theory to read John. Also, I was saying that this is actually something that you've already drawn the key connections, and then this is the icing.
That's
on the
fine.
Cake.
I was just taking the opportunity to troll you about details.
But on this, I think it really matters. There are ways in which you can make the whole case seem to rest upon a disputed point, and then what you've done essentially is kick the question into the long grass, and it actually becomes decisive for nothing. Whereas when Paul makes his arguments, what you often see is that he gives a framework of reasoning within which his actual conclusions begin to make a bit more sense. Now, if you don't know the context exactly, if you don't know exactly what those conclusions entail, you can at least go back through the reasoning or go forward into the reasoning and understand something of what's informing his position. And so that's what I'd emphasize, that we do have Paul's argument for his position, not just his statement of what must be done. And in that respect, I think what follows is not just domineering, it's not just a negative sense. And the way that Andrew has spoken about the positive sense of that term, or the broader sense of that term, I think holds on the basis of that wider reasoning that Paul gives. And so, more generally, I think these debates in complementarian, egalitarian arguments have become load-bearing at the impasses. They become load-bearing on those points that are disputed, and it commonly comes down to just one or two terms. So what does a helper suited for him mean? Or what does it mean to teach or exercise authority? Or what does it mean to be head? Or what does it mean to etc.? And so you're debating these very limited points, and you've lost the peripheral vision of Pauline argumentation or the scriptural reasoning. And as a result, everything becomes a matter, increasingly, of how do you want to read it? Because you could read it in all these different ways. And what I think we need to do is actually step back, get our peripheral vision in place again, attend to the Pauline reasoning, and then we can have less weight placed upon the points of dispute, the things that are less clear, and actually solve many of our questions without actually needing to depend upon a highly technical determination from some term that's used in various senses in the sources.
Alistair, I think I like all that. I agree with it. It's also just a great way of not answering the question or of dodging, right? The actual, there's a way in which
It's not the answer to the question. It's what we must do if we're going to get to an answer to the question.
That's right. That's right. Which is not quite the same thing.
I rejoice in it. I'm taking notes on how to not answer Matt's questions. I just think it's...
As someone who has written about questions, Matt, I'm sure you appreciate the unasking of questions.
I take that on board. Andrew, do you think that resolves, or that's your take on the authenteo side of things?
Yeah, I'm absolutely with Alistair on this point. And in fact, I think he introduced me to it, really, just like how little of the biblical vision of men and women, even in the church leadership context, let alone maleness and femaleness, how little of that actually depends on the interpretation of this verse or even this chapter. I think he and Hannah Anderson came to do a conference with me on it about 5-6 years ago. And really helped me see this sort of much, much broader canvas, which is what's informed all of my writing on it. In fact, the big essay I did on this at TGC was on maleness and femaleness, barely mentioned 1 Timothy 2, because I just don't think it is that central to the whole thing. But obviously you do have to read it, and it's usually the place where someone who doesn't like the kind of vision of male and female that I hold, or that Alistair holds, or that I think you hold, will kind of focus some attention, because it's the obvious proof texty knockdown thing, which is why what Alistair's just described happened. I think one example the book that was Andrew Bartlett's book, which is the one that Becky, who raised the question that prompted this conversation today, she wrote about his book, and she said, I just wonder what you thought about this. And basically what he does with it, he says, I mean, initially he makes an interesting comment, which I don't agree with at all, which is that Paul's words must be for particular people over whom he has jurisdiction, as the apostles who built up their Christian community. There is nothing in the text to suggest that he's here meaning to claim jurisdiction over future generations everywhere, which I find quite a little bit extraordinary, if I'm honest, because I think so much of the New Testament is written for very specific people. Like I said earlier, it's all contextual, but that doesn't mean it's not for other people everywhere. So I think that's something I definitely don't agree with him on. But his version is not dissimilar to what I said Tom Wright does with it. His gloss is, I am not permitting a woman false teacher with expensive and immodest dress, lacking decency and self-control, to teach and overpower a man. She's to be quiet and reverent and learn how to behave in accordance with the truth in full submission to God. And he obviously gives his defense of that and his attempt to read authenteo in that way, and not just authenteo, actually, but didasco. I think that's often a bigger problem, is you find yourself going, we found a way of reading authenteo that makes it sound like it's only a bad thing, but you still have to deal with didasco and say, Paul doesn't say, this is, I do not permit a woman to heterodidaskalane, it's to teach falsely. He just says, to teach. And then 3 or 4 verses later, if you just keep reading, you're in the middle of, you know, a couple of verses into chapter 3, and you're finding he says, you know, the elders, or the bishop or the overseer must be able to teach. And at that point you say, well, I've just restricted women from teaching, and now I'm saying overseers must be able to teach. Even if we said we don't know what authenteo means at all, and we don't do anything on that, you've still got the teaching question. So I don't find that way of reading the text convincing. I think we're better in many ways to, and this is what I would like to get Alistair's take on. Alistair, if I asked the question nicer, would you answer my version of it? Which is, to what extent do you find it persuasive? My attempt to go, I think we are talking about a restriction on teaching here, but Paul talks in other letters in ways that do not restrict teaching in the same way. Do you, A, accept that that is a phenomenon, and B, do you like, or do you have a better version of the interpretation I'm using to try and explain why both of those things are true?
Yes, I think we find broader uses of the concept of teaching elsewhere. And I think one thing that's important to note here is the gender-specific aspect of the objects of the teaching. That it's over men. And there's no statement about not doing this over women as well. If they were engaging in a sort of domineering form of false teaching, it would be no less dangerous for them to be exercising that over the women. And indeed, the women would seem to be the natural objects of such teaching. And they would be the ones who would be receiving the teaching from other women more than the men. And so the way that this is framed, and then the Genesis example in terms of the Adam-Eve polarity, I think complicates the arguments that some have. And so I think you're right to see there is a broader use of the concept of teaching elsewhere. This is maybe, maybe those two terms should be read alongside each other as interpreting each other, that there is a sort of authoritative teaching that takes place within the church, the authoritative handling of the tradition, for instance. And some have argued this, and some have argued this very much to open up roles for women that would fall under teaching in other taxonomies. So the idea that this is the authoritative passing on of the tradition, which belongs to the ordained teachers of the church, whereas there are these broader contexts of teaching, instructing, exhorting, whatever, that are not the authoritative sort of teaching that belongs to those who are appointed to that role. And so that's another position that is out there. I think if we follow the logic, there are broader things that would follow from this that require differences between men and women more generally, not in terms of an absolute prohibition, but there's a sense that this can't just be restricted to a very narrow context, and then outside of that, there's no difference that applies. Rather, there's a sense of propriety arising from the underlying creational establishment, which will lead to a degree of asymmetry everywhere. Now, that asymmetry is not the straightforward one teaches, one cannot teach, but it will play out more broadly. And so I think on that point, we might be in disagreement. I'm not sure.
So much happy harmony between you guys. I'm just impressed. I'm not surprised at all.
Can I just throw in on Authentia, just because I do think it's a helpful thing here. I made reference earlier to the fact that one of the key ancient, it's a very unusual word, and the reason why everyone gets very excited about it is because obviously it's a lexicographer's dream. You can go, hey, this one word is the entire hinge on which all male oppression of women hinges, and then look, and we could just go into these eight references and study astrology texts and this sort of thing, and then show that it's all wrong-headed. And obviously, I agree with Alistair that that's not really where the load-bearing should be distributed. But B, I do think this Tryphon's letter, which is the text I was referring to, this sort of, it's basically been a kerfuffle about a wage and a fare being paid for a boat crossing as part of a trade. And he's the writer of the letter is defending his conduct to his boss and saying, this is why I did what I did. But he said, this is where the word Authentio appears. He's engaging with the boatman. And he says, I was surprised that there was no argument. And since I had exercised authority towards him, he agreed within the hour to secure for Calatitis the boatman at the same fare. And so he's basically saying, I did well here, and I'm writing to you to explain why what I did was a good thing, and I think you should, you know, be pleased that I did. He's kind of boasting about it. He's not saying, oh, I authentioed him, and gosh, that's like a really sinister thing to kind of domineer and subvert. And he's actually saying, no, I exercised authority to him, and as a result, I'm a good servant, and I've done a good job. And so I do think that the attempts to kind of, now, of course, it could be an outlier, but I think there's only about eight examples like this in the literature, in anything close to the right period. And several of them are about astrology, which could be read either way, because how do stars, do they domineer each other, or do they just pull each other or have authority over each other? It's very hard to read. So I just don't think that that attempt works. And then I think you see the teaching point as well, and you say that is in Paul when it's not made explicitly negative, is also a positive thing. And Alistair's very important point, why would it be okay for a woman to teach or have authority in a negative way over a woman either? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Paul's, why would he say that? So I just think that the straight way that you'd read it in the NIV, they use assume authority, the ESV, exercise authority, have authority. I just think that's a better way to read that particular verse. And then I think we've got to work out, so how then do you integrate, harmonize that with some of these other texts which we had? But do you want to go to 215 for a minute? Because that we you touched on that at the start, and we're otherwise going to run out of time, and that's a really...
Yeah.
Woo-hoo, a fun verse.
Might Alistair, as well. Alistair, I mean, we've just done all the hot takes in this one episode, so, you know, might as well just tank our iTunes reviews. Just go for it all. Sink us, Alistair. How should we read? Yet she will be saved through childbearing. So one way of reading this would be as a kind of proto-evangelium type of allusion, right? So you have Adam was formed first, then Eve. So you have a recounting of this story. And so she will be saved through childbearing is as an allusion to the Mary, essentially, giving birth to Christ. I don't think that that's... That while that seems right and true, it still has purchase on the they, if they continue in faith and love and holiness. There's something about what women are supposed to be doing. There's one contextual reading that I am interested in, which is something like maybe women in Ephesus are abdicating childbearing, that they're giving up, that they have taken the gospel in such ways that actually they're, you know, maternal mortality is so high and they do have all the Artemis stuff happening. And so they're just giving up on having children because it's both dangerous and they don't have reasons to anymore. And so Paul is actually saying, actually, you will be protected and preserved through childbearing. I think that's a reasonable reading. And certainly if you want, this is the last point, Alistair, and then I'm going to throw to you. If you want a pronatalist book of the New Testament, 1 Timothy is it, right? It's the only, I think, explicit admonition that people should have babies. Later on, when Paul speaks to young widows, he says, I encourage them to marry and have children and actually be the paterfamilias, effectively, of their homes in the Greek term, which is very interesting in this light as well. So there's some way in which, if there are women who are turning away from having children, Paul is offering theological grounds for continuing to do so here. Those are just a smattering of thoughts. Alistair, how have you read this bit of the passage?
Well, again, one of the helpful things to do is to step back just a little and to think about the way that the preceding verses are part of a broader sketching of the story of Genesis 1 to 3. And so this appears in the context of that. You have the fact that Adam is formed first, Eve is formed second, that Eve is deceived, Adam is not deceived. We didn't get into that detail, but I think that's an important one and has often been taken in unhelpful ways on both sides of the debate. And then finally, that the woman will be saved through childbearing. And it seems to me that this follows through the logic, first of all, of creation and then fall and then promise and redemption. Within the context of the fall, it is the woman's childbearing that is emphasized. The woman and her seed are going to have enmity with the serpent, and that is the framework of the story of salvation in many respects, that we see in somewhere like Revelation 12, the woman in the heavens giving birth and the defeat of the dragon by her son. And then you have the way in which Genesis 3:16 follows on from that and speaks about the woman's role in particular and the way in which she will bring forth fruit with pain. And that's paralleled with the man bringing forth fruit from the earth. Now, as we follow that logic through, I think it takes us through the entire biblical narrative. The entire biblical narrative, again and again, focuses upon women struggling in childbirth. It's the story of Genesis with Sarah, with Rebecca, with Rachel, all of whom struggle in childbirth. This is part integral to the biblical drama of salvation. The story of the Exodus begins with women struggling in birth. The story of the kingdom begins with Hannah struggling. And then the story of the gospel begins with Mary and Elizabeth. And then you have the story of redemption framed as Zion struggling to bring forth her children. And so the idea that women would be marginalized from the story of salvation because they're just staying at home, just bearing children, is to utterly misunderstand the shape of that story. And so it seems to me that what Paul is saying is follow this line through. And on the one hand, you'll understand the difference between male and female established at the beginning. But you'll also understand that that very thing that would seem to marginalize women actually gives them central stage at those critical moments. And I think we see this throughout the Gospels and throughout the scripture. And if you have that as your guiding story, then women will have prominence and respect and honor within the life of the congregation, even if they're not the ones who are the chief guardians of the church. And so you have the guardian figure is a sort of Joseph, but there's a Mary in the story. And so what you need is this understanding of the shape of salvation, and you won't have the sort of patriarchal, domineering male context, but nor will you have this context where women have to abdicate childbearing in order to have prominence and honor.
So how do you read saved through Sozo Dia?
Yes, I think that's an important part of it, that first of all, our salvation is not just a once-off thing. It's part of an ongoing participation in the life of Christ and entrance into that life and the consummation of that life in the age to come. Now, if you have this understanding of salvation that is detached from the realm of the body, for instance, or one that sees everything as overly realized, that's going to cause problems for childbearing. It's going to give the suggestion that at this point, the life of the family is abdicated. We're all spiritual at this point because of Christ. He is the true seed. He's come. That whole story of the body and of childbearing has ended. If you have that understanding, then the role of women will be very much marginalized, and they'll be seeing their prominence arising by conforming more to the role of men. I mean, you have to become male to enter the kingdom of God, or that is the reward for entering the kingdom of God, which you see in some Gnostic texts. And salvation through childbearing is that this is part of the natural way in which the story of salvation plays out for women within the life of the church, just as it would typically be the case for men within the life of the church, that their salvation occurs through bearing children and fathering children. And so, or fathering children, it seems that understanding of salvation is maybe a broader one than we typically use in our employment of that term. But
can I ask? We've got to wrap up here, Andrew. Can I ask? And Alistair, I mean, you can respond to this too, because the one analogy or the one parallel text that I thought about in thinking about this again in preparation for the show was in 1 Corinthians, where when those who are receiving communion inappropriately seem like they're getting sick and dying. And like, from what I can tell, the way I read that, it's very hard to read it as anything other than that their bodies are actually getting sick and dying, whether it's because they're eating, you know, there's something genuinely mystical about that, or it's because the form of the meal that they're indulging in is so decadent that it's causing sort of medical problems. But however you take that, I think Paul does seem in that moment to really correlate the providential grace of God with health. And this seems like a kind of parallel case in one way, where save through childbearing might just mean, because it's conditional. It's if they continue in faith and love and holiness with self-control. And is it the case that there's a kind of parallel case here where there is a kind of tacit promise that fidelity to the gospel will protect women's lives through this extremely dangerous process of bearing children, because we've seen God bring Mary through a very dangerous, you know, like all of the births, Alistair, that you mentioned in these contexts are extremely dangerous, seems to me, because in many cases they're elderly women, right? These are going to be above average difficult childbirths, it seems to me. And I just wonder if there's something that's actually that granular here, where Paul really does think that there is some sort of providential promise to women here that they will be protected through this process.
Can I just add to that, that I think that's a critical point. We focus very much upon men going out to war, facing a situation of life and death. Childbirth is a situation of life and death. And particularly within the ancient world, and even up to the relatively modern day, childbirth has been a context where women bravely face the force of death and new life. And it's a context of genuine threat. It's a context where they shed their blood. And in that context, it should be seen as actually part of the drama of salvation, of conflict with the evil one, and of a context where souls are at stake and life and death things are taking place, and they can be assured of that God is present in that situation, that that is part of the story of salvation, and that they are actors within it by the power of the Holy Spirit. And that comfort, they're not just living out the consequences of the curse upon Eve.
Yeah.
They are part of the story of salvation, and God is with them in that time as they face death.
I think that's a great word to end on, unless, Andrew, you would like to tell me how right I am as well. I'm always welcome to you guys confirming my readings on things.
No, I'm I don't read it that way.
That was purely for the purpose of the joke, Andrew.
I read it slightly differently from even how Alistair said it as well. But I think it is a difficult verse, no matter how you slice it. I think the referent of what childbearing is, whose childbirth it is, what saved means, what through means. I mean, those three words in particular are tricky. But I think you can make a good defense of either of those two views, and the one I hold, which is that the women are being saved from Satan through having children and managing the household. So the same idea is in chapter 5, basically, saved from the enemy trying to lead people away from the faith, which is overlaps with Alistair's, I think. So there's lots of ways of doing it, but it is a difficult text, and it's probably good at times just to hold your hand up and go, yeah, I could very easily be wrong about this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that was, I really appreciated that discussion. I find that really clarifying. So.
And the great question, which we will have to take up at another point, would be, given all of this, how is it that virgins become so prominent within the life of the early church, which is a key point, I think, for understanding both 1 Timothy and 1 Corinthians, but then the development of Christian doctrine, Christian teaching of sex and marriage. But as I say, that will be for a future conversation. If you have enjoyed this show, we would love to hear from you. You can send us a note at mirafidelity.com. Or if you've hated this show, we read our hate mail as well. So drop us a line. We do love to hear from you. We are going to be back in the weeks to come. I think we've reached out to a few guests to come on at this point. So we're going to get back to talking with a few other outsiders to the group here. But we are also going to carry on with other conversations about scripture, the world around us. Until then, though, this has been Mere Fidelity.